I open the House Committee on Water and Environment. We'll open in a subcommittee here without enough members and not a quorum, but it gives a chance at least to get a hearing going. And we'll start with Senate Bill. As I see, we have two esteemed senators here, and as I understand, Senator Timms has been here the longest. We'll start with 965. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 965. See, I did check on that real quick. See, who's been here the longest?
Very good chair. Very good.
And I want to make sure there's certainly wasn't any politics in that decision, right? Not with Senator Yeager, no?
Yes, right. Well, she's a pretty special person.
Yes, she is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Adrian, State Senator from District Number 30. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 965, which was brought to the Oregon Legislature by the gentleman sitting to the left, Dave Harmon, who's the administrator of the Hunt County Hospital in Burns, Oregon. And I will read the testimony here that I haven't read, or didn't read in the Senate side, but the way to do it when I'm in the House, I try and do a better job. Currently, property owned by health districts is exempt from property taxes. As a physician recruiting incentive, the Harney County Hospital built a medical office building. The hospital is owned by the health district and is exempt from property taxes. The new medical office building is also owned by the health district and therefore exempt from property taxes. The district charges the physician's rent for their offices, but because the district is exempt from property taxes, it does not exclude taxes in the rental overhead. However, because the district rents the property, the law permits the renters themselves to be subject to property taxes. Although when the taxes are not paid by the individual, the taxes become lien against the health district, which is tax exempt. Senate Bill 965 is designed to clarify the status allowing for health districts in Pioneer County, that's 6 people per square mile or less, and their properties to be exempt from property taxes, even though the district rents property to health care providers or practitioners. And the county is a frontier rural practice county under the rules adopted by the Office of Rural Health. While this legislation may be viewed by some as detrimental to these small counties' abilities to generate revenue, I submit to you that the challenge of providing quality health care to these rural communities is a higher priority. Without a hospital and the physicians to provide medical services to the local taxpayers, these frontier counties will soon find economic development and an expanded tax base an impossibility. There are 11 counties defined as frontier, less than 6 persons or less per square mile. 9 contain health districts, only 4 contain hospitals. The rulemaking authority contained in the bill, given the Office of Rural Health, prevents possible administrative abuses. Since the 4 hospitals are already supported by local tax subsidies, it makes no logical sense to allow property tax liens to accrue to a district hospital. This will only cloud the title to the property and cause additional administrative work for the county assessor's office. Additionally, it will make recruiting and retaining health care providers more difficult than it already is. This bill is another small step in the ongoing effort to guarantee rural Oregonians have access to health care. I'm asking for your support of Senate Bill 965. With that, I'm up to questions, or we can move on to the other.
Sure.
Agenda.
Continue with others that have testimony.
Could you give us the staff, please?
My name is Dave Harmon. I'm the administrator of Harney District Hospital in Burns, Oregon, and I'm happy to appear before you today. I hope I'm not too groggy. You'll have to forgive me. I was down to my son-in-law's graduation yesterday in Los Angeles when I got the call that we were testifying today. So we were driving back to Burns. We got back to Burns. We left at 6 yesterday morning, got back about 8 last night, and got to drive to Salem then. And I left my glasses at home, so at least I remembered a jacket. Anyhow, I do appreciate being able to be here this morning. As Senator Tim said, I was the one that asked for 965. And I'll just go down through this testimony. In addition to being the hospital administrator in Burns now for nearly 10 years, I've also served as rural hospital administrator in Canyonville, Oregon, which is a little south of Roseburg, for 7. Currently serve on the governing boards of the Hospital Association, Rural Health Association, the Central Oregon Network of Hospitals, and the Central Oregon Independent Health Services, past chair of the Cascades East Area Health Education Center. I'm actually very fortunate to be involved in rural health care in Oregon and can testify both to the joys and the difficulties. One of the major difficulties we encounter is the recruitment and retention of healthcare professionals, particularly physicians. In the mid-80s, Harney County experienced a dramatic loss of physicians due to various reasons, ultimately leaving only one physician actively practicing in the county. And obviously, one couldn't serve the needs, and many residents were forced to drive either 130 miles west to Bend or 130 miles east to Ontario. The hospital's patient volume dropped proportionately, with annual operating losses nearly $750,000. And this scenario, while not unique to Harney County and continuing to be played out in other areas, is hopefully not as severe in these other areas. In 89, through a combination of hard work and good fortune, the community was able to begin recruiting. We recruited a family physician and a general surgeon. In the following years, we continued to be successful due to a number of factors, including our new medical office building. It was first conceived in 96 and opened in October of 98. This new building replaced the former clinic, which was built in 1950, which was too small and inefficient. Actually, our patients kind of got a kick out of it because you could hear what was going on in every room in the building. It was not a very good building. It was nice. It's nice to both for the convenience of the staff and the patients and the privacy. That's been a very, I can't stress enough how big a recruiting tool that is for us. We're part of the, this isn't in the testimony, but we're part of the Area Health Education Center family residency program in Klamath Falls, and we have residents now full-time year-round, and I can't tell you how many comments I've heard from the residents coming through about how nice that building is and how they'd like to come back and practice there. We actually now have one female physician from the residency program, former graduate, and we hope to have more in the future. And I appreciate your support of that program, too, by the way. The building was built by the health district to enhance the medical community and ensure an adequate and stable supply of physicians in the county. It's a relatively common practice for hospitals to own these buildings. And for doctors who want to practice in these buildings and not become building owners, in rural areas such as ours that are financially fragile, the building of such a facility is a real challenge. Together with our med staff, we conceived this building, which would serve as physicians and the community. It's financed by the district, but it's actually paid for by the physicians through rent receipts. It seems fair to everybody involved. It's actually working. However, in developing the financing, we didn't allow for property taxes, as we were tax exempt and understood that the operation of the medical office building was an accepted related hospital operation. Subsequently, we discovered that while the district couldn't be taxed, the law allowed for property taxes to be levied against the physicians renting the building. The slight positive effect of a marginal increase in county property taxes would be offset by several very negative effects. First and most important is rent and operating costs for the building are already significantly higher than they were in the prior facility nationally, and Burns in general, we're charging about $1.25 a foot, square foot for that building, which is really high in our area. The additional expense of property tax would be a disincentive for the continued recruitment and retention of physicians. And second, though the taxes are levied against the physician, there's really no requirement for them to pay, and any subsequent liens are against the district property. This could place an additional burden on the district should it ever want to sell the property, and if it doesn't ever want to sell, it's really nothing is ever going to happen. And as it says, since the district probably wouldn't sell the property, the whole process is a waste of county resources in assessing, taxing, and liening for no purpose. I ask for this legislation to be drafted. It's presented legislation would only apply to health districts in frontier counties such as Harney, Lake, and Grant. Actually, I left one off as Wow. I think it's the only other county this would apply to. It would help these communities with physician recruitment and retention. It would not reduce taxes in effect, as these properties have never been previously taxed anyhow. It would eliminate needless paperwork. I've discussed this with our county officials, have their endorsement, and ask this committee to approve this bill recommended to the House for passage. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ed Patterson, I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I just want to make a couple of points, and I hope at least that your staff has passed out the Legislative Revenue Office revenue impact on this proposed bill. It looks like this. I assume you have that in front of you. Just to draw your attention to the first paragraph, the measure description, and it says in part that under current law, it is unclear how counties are to treat property that a health district, like a hospital, owns but leases or rents to other health providers like doctors. And so this bill specifically clarifies that vagary in the law, and we think clarifies it to the extent it will be, which will hold the tax districts harmless. Secondly, there is an amendment that has been, I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe this amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, and I believe it was proposed by the county, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm not positive about that either. But on the Senate side, the counties testified that they wanted the counties to have the option of allowing this exemption or not allowing the exemption. And Senator Randy Miller, who chaired that committee, encouraged us to find that kind of a compromise, knowing full well that, at least in the part of Harney County government, they were supportive of this exemption. So we agreed to that. Subsequently, Senator Miller went to Legislative Council and asked for that amendment to be drafted for the bill, and Legislative Council gave the opinion that that was unconstitutional, and you couldn't do that because the county government doesn't have that kind of authority to grant exemptions for other taxing districts. So what happened was, I think Legislative Council went back to work and drafted the Dash 1 amendments, but we think these are unworkable. This is not what we agreed to on the Senate side. Essentially what would happen was that each individual taxing district within the health district would have the option of opting in or opting out of the exemption. And you may have 10 or 12 different tax districts, all kinds of little districts, especially in the rural parts of the state, have taxing authority. So in essence, if even one of those taxing districts said, no, we're not going to grant the exemption, then you would still have something of a tax liability accruing to the tax-exempt health district. So we would oppose the Dash 1 amendments and would encourage you to adopt the bill as it was presented to you from the Senate committee, and we'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? Representative Taylor.
Thank you. I do have some questions. Are the physicians then leasing the property from the health district? Is that the situation?
That's correct. They're renting individually.
And there was no consideration given to the fact that, I mean, it escapes you that there would be property tax since they were not.
It escaped our attorney. I asked that particular question. He said, no, that's a related business enterprise, so there wouldn't be being a health district. Ed said, the law is a little vague, and his interpretation was the other way around, that it wouldn't. And then I had a surprise call from our assessor and said, Merry Christmas.
If I might continue, yes. My concern is this, that in Astoria we have a physician who, from his private loan, has constructed a $4 million facility recently and is now seeking, through Senator Lynn's bill, to be exempt from property taxes under an enterprise zone that doesn't exist because last 2 years ago, that he had applied prior to that. So this bill was written to go back retroactively. And in talking to people there, they said, well, you know, the clinic is going to require fire and police protection, the same as any other place in the county, and the city and county would be expected to provide that. So I guess I would be more comfortable if I knew that the county was willing to waive the property taxes, because it's my feeling that the cost of those services then might be diffused to residential or other business property taxpayers. I understand your situation, and I'm sympathetic to it. I think getting physicians to rural Oregon is a challenge, and I appreciate the job you've done here.
Well, I'll show you come. For the record, Gene Timms, State Senator. Jackie, I think in your case, you're talking about a separate building that is being built by the doctors, right? In this case, we're talking about a building that is built by the health district. When I first started in this process, I was on the hospital board before I became a state senator. And Lakeview was an area that put their doctors inside the hospital. I said, what a great idea. Because then you don't have duplication of equipment, those type things. The hospital doesn't compete with the clinic. And to me, it makes sense that those doctors be made the hospital because we can't afford that duplication of equipment. Our health costs are already high because of the census in the hospital and those types of things that relate to the cost of health care. And so in your case, it's a different situation. If it's a clinic away from the hospital, I believe they always have paid taxes and will pay taxes. But it's a clinic, basically, that the doctors are housed in the health district, which is exempt. It makes sense that it's exempt because it gives those doctors a media to work through as professionals in cooperation with the hospital.
Sure, can I expand on that just a little bit? Also, something that may have escaped members of the committee, Dave indicated that his hospital is supported by property taxes already, so the patrons within the health district are probably $200,000 a year.
$500,000.
Are paying $500,000 a year in property taxes for the very services that you alluded to. So there is a distinctive difference between district hospital, and they're all supported by property taxes, okay, and a privately established clinic.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Any other questions? Thank you for great job explaining that. Thank you. And for the record, I'll note that we do have a quorum and we are in full committee. Okay. Let's, I'll close hearing on Senate Bill 965. And we'll open a hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 13, right? 13B. And Senator E.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, which comprises of portions of Lynn and Benton County, neighboring Chairman's District. I'm here to testify on support of Senator John Memorial 13. Senator John Memorial 13 asks the federal government to appropriate $1 million to support the Northwestern Oregon, Southwestern Washington, Canada Goose Agriculture Depredation Control Program instituted last year to help alleviate part of the massive damage our farmers are suffering from the large number of wintering Canada geese. The memorial also requests $14 million to start a contract feed program for area farmers to grow crops to feed the overwintering geese and also fund more food crop production on area refuges and sanctuaries to take some of the goose pressure off our farming community. The request total is $15 million. The value of Oregon crops lost to geese over the 1997 production year. Although there were losses elsewhere in the state, the Willamette Valley producers received the majority of the $15 million in crop damage. It would take at least that much money to feed the nearly 300,000 geese, up from 20,000 in the 1970s, now living through the winter and early spring in the Willamette Valley. This memorial, in short, asks the federal government to live up to its agreement or obligation related to the plan to help reduce the economic effect of its Canada Goose policy. The memorial also asks the federal government to provide the state of Oregon with funds to help our farmers produce the food necessary to feed the large population of geese. The federal government policy has unfairly committed us to maintain for them, and I urge for your support. Pete Tess from Farm Bureau is also here to help answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Come on up, Pete. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Yes.
Questions?
Yep.
Representative Mackey.
Pete, I have a question. Where in Canada are these geese?
For the record, Pete Testore and Farm Bureau Federation.
Yes, if I might be excused, I'm going back.
Yes, thank you, Senator.
There you
go. All right.
Chairman Wiles, Representative Atkinson. There are seven varieties or seven subspecies of geese that winter in the Willamette Valley and further south. Some of them occur in Canada, but the ones that are the majority of the population, the calving Canada geese, are in Alaska. And I'm not sure exactly what part of Alaska they're in. And the other, the more important ones, the dusky Canada goose, which is at a very low population level, it's not listed, but coming close, is in the Copper River Delta that was raised somewhat in elevation by an earthquake in, I believe, the 60s, and changed the habitat and has caused some population problems with them. And basically, the cackling geese are used by the Alaskan natives for hunting and food purposes. They have to keep their populations. The federal government has a 260,000 population minimum for them to continue their food use. And we have the duskies that are being carefully watched. So with the other six or five varieties that are here that are not any problem, everything's going to build population. The cactus used to winter in California, now they winter here, I guess, because it's a nice spot for hunting. So consequently, we have this unnatural or artificial population of geese that build up in the Willamette Valley because of policy related to the dusky and cackling geese in Alaska.
I don't want to, Mr. Chairman, talk the bill again.
It's a great bill. There's a
couple of things here that fascinate me. First of all, is that there was a big disease of that swept through ducks in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and it pretty much
took duck
levels down over the last 5 to 6 years. Took them really, really low. At the same time, on this side of the Cascades,
their flight patterns actually would be down through southern, eastern, and Idaho. That was their flight pattern.
And over the same 10 years, we had this growth in the Willamette Valley of these birds. The thing that's fascinating to me is the changes of the migration. I could talk about this all day. I was just curious. I think at a certain level, disease occasionally will catch up and straighten things out, but this bill should not be held up for that. And I also should declare a conflict of interest, as I enjoy goose deprivation and would also apply for the job if there's a federal job available.
We could probably find them about $14 million if they really gave.
That's increased.
Thank you. How big is the non-migratory population of geese in Alaska?
Representative Welsh said, Representative Cruz, I don't know. I know it has grown dramatically in the last few years. You'd have to ask Fish and Game. I'd hesitate to make a call on that. I know that it has grown dramatically, particularly in the Willamette Valley in your country. We have major problems starting to show up in the Klamath area. And it's just going out of proportion. But that's not it's that way all over the country.
There are several things that come into play here, and the non-migratory geese population is certainly, I think, a major contributing factor to this. And I appreciate the problem having the Lawrence Valley, but it should also be stated and Senator Yee alluded to it that we have a major problem in Southern Oregon too. A major problem in Southern Oregon, and as a farmer, I have had a major problem, and we are left with very little remedy or very little way to deal with the problem, simply because they're going to go where the food is, and all we're allowed to do basically is hazing, and that doesn't work, because they're used to it more than virtual does. So,
Representative Cruz, I agree. In fact, and even the hunting that you have, which is much wider spread, and the potential for actually getting killed from this summer is probably a lot larger because you don't have the duskies or cacklers. This is just, like I say, a nationwide problem. Obviously, we know how Senate Joint Memorials are are handled when they go to Washington, D.C., we have actually asked for $2 million to help carry out this depredation program formally to our congressional delegation. And we hope that this would kind of keep it in front so we could actually get that money. If they gave us the $14 million, I'd hand feed those geese myself.
Me too. I think it was 1990 when I first ran for office that a farmer told me that on Clinton Island one year, 8 geese came, and the next year 20, and the next year 200, and shortly thereafter 2,000. And he described that what they didn't eat, they made a deposit on. And so I my concern is that if we're going to feed them, in an attempt to confine them, you know, the experience of the Caspian Tern there on Rice Island in the Lower Columbia hasn't proved to be too successful. It's a different kind of approach. But I know that my hunter friends tell me they don't hunt geese anymore because they're hard to identify the threatened species from the, from the others. And I think that there's a need for emphasis with hunter identification, although I know the department is doing some of that, but...
Chairman Walsh, Representative Taylor, we've worked really hard with Oregon Hunters Association, Oregon Duck Hunters, and others to help try and get places for people to hunt in the valley. We're trying to expand to do what we can with hunting season in the way of hazing, but I wanted to add maybe one thing. You mentioned about depositing stuff on the fields. It kind of sounds funny, but I have a EPA report that shows that a Canada goose deposits the same amount of fecal coliform in a day as 10 cows. One goose equivalent to 10 cows of fecal coliform. I can provide you that information. So there is a potential problem here as far as water quality when we start hauling new fecal coliform in our streams running off fields that turn green. I will provide that information if you want, just so you can make sure it sounds so outlandish that I will provide it as I did with the Senate committee. So that is an issue.
I think the report.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, give a whole new meaning to that old phrase, great bobs of goose grease.
That's fine.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, it doesn't bring that very much. Well, it's a, I have hunters in my district, and of course my district, and it's 3 years ago that I started lobbying our representative and congressman to deposit on this issue, too. And it is now, you know, they allow this hunting, changes in time for hunting the geese. They got some good programs, private property owners involved, but then all of a sudden they're discouraged when they have to keep track immediately when they kill a goose. And if, then they go through a, after they get on the highway, they go to a checkpoint, check them out and everything. And a friend of mine down there, after hunting, was almost illegally searched after this when they cannot properly identify a goose. Federal officer and a state officer. And so they accused him of shooting the wrong goose. And so he appealed, and they went on to a state biologist, and the state biologist had a problem, could not identify it. So it's real, and he was assessed $100-some-odd fine on this. And so we took that through the process here and everything. It's a problem. It's a big problem. And the hunters, if that's the kind of harassment they get, too, in this, they won't be a part of the solution. After property owners have gone to a great program, a training program for all hunters and everything, and we still can't get to the problem because they're going to be harassed on identification. We need help.
And that is a major issue. Many of the hunters have that problem, and it is getting worse. I haven't even managed to take the test because I can't tell shades of gray in the shadows either. So it's not going to be an easy issue. Part of the reason we're asking for the money, federal government has a policy not to pay for wildlife damage. They will not compensate. So what we thought we'd do is turn the tables and say we'll contract feed. So in a sense, we're compensating before the damage. And that's kind of what we looked at this program. And when people sign up, and if they get damaged, then they get paid. If they don't, their contract is invalid. They don't get paid. So they can't tell us we're asking for compensation. So that's kind of the idea behind the $15 or $14 million. But obviously, like I said, we know where that really probably ended up.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just wanted to make a statement. You know, the area that I live in, this is really a problem. And what I was, I can hardly wait to go home and tell my husband what I heard everyone saying, because years ago I was goose hunting with him, and I thought we had to make sure we didn't shoot duskies. Am I calling it the right thing, duskies? And so he says, shoot, and I'm going, well, I'm not sure. Shoot, we're not going to get any closer. They're not going to get any closer. What's the matter with you? I said, I couldn't be sure. And so to hear all three of you say that, I can hardly wait to go home and say, hey, other people say that. <identify." laughs> Well, we do have a problem.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions, concerns? Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it. Anyone else want to give testimony? Okay. I'll close the hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 13 and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 13. Representative Atkinson.
Move Senate Joint Memorial 13B to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Joint Memorial 13B to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. And we have Representative Devlin with us if he would like to vote on Senate Joint Memorial 13, Goose Depredation, Message to Congress. Everybody was a yes.
Yes.
Representative Devlin is a yes.
The memorial says that we're going to move all the geese to Lake Oswego.
Okay, having a required number of votes, Senate Joint Memorial 13B has floor to do pass recommendation. Do we have a carrier? Jason Atkinson. Representative Atkinson will be our carrier. Thank you very much. We close the work session on Senate Joint Memorial 13. We open the hearing on Senate Bill 989. No, yeah, yes. We still, okay. No, we will not open the book session. Senate Bill 989 will reopen to Senate Bill 965. We have more testimony. Sorry about that. We have Bob Cantarn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties, and the previous testimony you had on Senate Bill 965, there were some comments on the Dash 1 amendments, and they were correct that those were requested by the Association of Oregon Counties, and they, I think, are part of the policy pattern that at least was developed in the House Revenue Committee as we began to address the issue of tax exemptions and how to treat those, where should the approval authority reside for different kinds of exemptions, and I think this one fits the same kind of issue as we have with the long-term care facilities that are heavily Medicaid funded, the other housing type exemptions where the Revenue Committee says those really will give our blessing to them if we choose to do so, but also there needs to be added to that the blessing of the local community, the political subdivisions from whom the property tax is going to be exempt. Testimony was also correct, my understanding, although I haven't been the one that's taken the lead on all of these, that the original concept, I think, was that it could be done by a single entity, and then the Legislative Council's office said, no, one taxing district can't exempt taxes for another taxing district locally. The county cannot, unless I assume we amended the Constitution, like you do with urban renewal, exempt taxes that are due to the city. So for that reason, the amendment is drawn in the fashion that you see it. I still feel that that's not a high price for the hospital district to pay. It is a community operation created by the community. I don't think it would be that difficult for them to file the request with the entities that might be involved. I don't know if the hospital district in Harnett County is a countywide district. That would subject it to more special district requests for the exemption. But again, it's something that is supported by that community if it's countywide, and I don't think that's an undue burden to ask that be done in that fashion. It is clearly not, at least in my judgment, not a statewide issue. We're talking just about a select group of counties that are called frontier counties. Those are the ones that need to make the decisions here. I realize that it may not be as easy as just going to the county and asking the county to do it, but that's part of the policy development process that's been going on here in this legislature on how to deal with tax exemptions. So I would ask for your favorable consideration of that. Thank you.
Bob, the health district is being paid for by taxes by the constituents of that district, right?
Because
they are already paying.
They apparently are levying a property tax to support that health district. That's correct.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, Bob, I understood that the doctor was being taxed, not the county.
I believe the ultimate lien or obligation for the payment of the tax goes back to the hospital district itself. I would, in some ways, it's kind of equivalent to any other governmental building, I assume, which leases out space to private parties. That portion of the building is subject to tax. We have that at the local government center. Portion of it are tax exempt. The portion you lease out to private interest is taxable. And that's the case of what they have here is very similar to that.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Bob. Okay, the closed hearing on Senate Bill. Maybe I'll ask a question. Does anyone else want to give testimony that's not signed up? Okay, I'll close hearing on Senate Bill 965. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 989. Glenn Stonebrink.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Community Housing Association. Senate Bill 989 addresses the issue of the federal government purchasing more high-end systems in the state of Oregon. There is a U.S. Constitution provision on the handout that states that the legislature of a particular state that we're discussing the purchasing has the authority and, in fact, the obligation to agree or disagree with that federal purchase. That is, if in fact, the federal government begins to have exclusive legislative authority over the functioning of that property and the activities that take place.
Oregon presently is
that 52%, over half of the state of Oregon, is under federal management of public lands.
There is growing concern and effort
hundreds to the appropriated billions of dollars to purchase more land within the state for various reasons, mostly for
habitat and that sort of thing.
What this bill
does,
what happened in 1967, the Oregon legislature
passed certain provisions art belonged to the federal government to purchase without the consent of the legislature.
So, and I have provided those
page of the Staples one, so you can see crosses those provisions out. And that then would require
that the legislature would consent for history that federal purchases in the future. One of the main reasons for this is because, for example, if the president wants to purchase a ranch, a working ranch in a rural area,
and turn it into a bird refuge, which they have done, that bird refuge pays no taxes to the county in property tax. There's no in lieu of taxes that goes to the county. And this is a continuing decrease in the tax base, and as you just heard from previous bills, for things like health care facilities and operations. And, of course, one of our biggest issues in the legislature to hit things like this for education. That's also the education and the funding. The additional provision that in this bill, besides removing the old provisions, would be to allow the county government a decision-making role when it comes to particular land purchases within their counties. And those two particular provisions are for the migratory bird refuges, and I have, by the way, if you want to look at it, I have the copies of the Migratory Bird Act, as well as the what is known as the Act of March 1st, 1911. That's the one that deals with increases purchases that will be added to the national forest system. In those two particular cases, the county then would be consulted by the legislature to see if the county government approves of that purchase or not. Because that's, again, where the major tax base loss would occur. I also provided to you a copy of the Federalist Papers that deals with this particular clause of the U.S. Constitution. It was definitely the intent of the makers of the U.S. Constitution to see that the federal government didn't just simply continue to purchase lands within the states until they could own virtually all of the state. And in some cases in the West, they still own virtually all of the state. But we believe that this is a bill that would put the authority granted by the U.S. Constitution back to the legislature where they intended for it to be and to deal with that issue and the intent of that. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Stonebreak, I am, to start off with, concerned about the repeal of the conveyance of sites to aid for navigation. That's very important in the district I'm representing. And I know that there may be in Lower Columbia some, I don't know whether the state submersible land extend to the area where the aids are actually placed within the river, but on the bank also. So I question what your intent was in dealing that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, while I can understand your concern in your particular area, there are other areas that may not have that concern, which they'd want to purchase land in other areas that stating for navigation, because as you understand, navigable streams now has gone a far distance from the coastal areas, considerable distances up river. And so this purchase could also be, I'll use the word land grab by the federal government in order to deal with, you know, purchasing the beds of the streams and this sort of thing, which is a controversial issue, I understand it, but presently, unless it's a navigable stream, they are owned by the property owner, usually to the midstream. However, the provisions do not prohibit the federal government from doing this. There's two things. The federal government may purchase that land,
without consent of the legislature if they do not intend to have exclusive legislative authority over that property. And that, I got that turned up with legislative counsel, and that's a particular note that's in my statement. So if they do not plan to have exclusive legislative authority over that purchased land, they can purchase it without your consent. The second thing, they can still purchase it if they get your consent. And they basically, what they're doing is they have to make their case to the legislature why it's needed, why it's feasible, why it's a good thing for the people of Oregon. And that's where the representation would come in. And let's, for an example, if it were in your district and this was necessary, you would be making your case why the legislature should agree to the purchase.
Mr. Chair, if I might continue, my concern is that the legislature only meets every 2 years and that there might be a need that would arise other than the 6 months that we're in session. I'm also thinking about the channel deepening. You know, obviously that is something that's going to aid navigation. And I don't know everything, all the issues connected with that. I know some of them, but it would be interesting to hear from the Division of State Lands on this particular repeal of proposed. I have other concerns.
Could I answer that one particular one, Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor? Presently, deepening the channel does not require ownership of the channel, so they wouldn't have to purchase it to be able to deepen it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this bill exclusively address situations under which the state owns the land and wants to convey it to the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, this would be any purchase of lands within the state. So it could be state-owned property. It could be privately owned property as well. The case I gave earlier where oftentimes what happens is, say, a ranch is purchased and then it's converted by the federal government, then it's converted into a bird refuge, and that would be buying it from a private ownership. Yes.
Second question. Yes. Would the state currently, for property within the state doesn't own, have to consent for a sale to the federal government if it's private property?
Chairman, Representative Devlin, no, they do not, and that's, these provisions allow them to purchase without the consent of the legislature.
But it would be with the consent of county?
Presently, Representative Devlin, the county government, if you'll see on the page where I have ORSs, and 272.050, county governing bodies to approve acquisition of national forests, and this is the same. We removed that provision and then we put it back in because it wouldn't be the same provision. So presently, only if they're going to deal with national forests, the counties have some authority over that. But if it was a bird refuge, no, they would not have that.
Okay. Chris, I'm asking from Mr. Chair.
Well, I apologize. I'm standing on the side. Question or comment. Did you tell the committee what percentage of the Oregon is owned by federal government?
Chairman, Representative Atkinson, yes, it's 52% and growing.
And that 52% is largely east or west of the Cascades?
Representative Atkinson, it's primarily in the eastern side of the state of Oregon and the two-thirds east of the Cascades. And so some of our counties, you know, run up into the 80s and virtually 90% federally owned.
If you were to look at a swath an entire map of the United States, would there be a swath including eastern Oregon? This is just a setup question, because there is a swath, let me explain. Between eastern Oregon, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, part of Arizona, and New Mexico, the swath kind of goes like this, in which the federal government is the primary owner, I believe, at that point, and I know you know what I'm talking about. It's close to 90% ownership. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, that's correct.
if I may just give one comment quickly. This issue has taken several years before it's gotten here. This is an issue, public lands issue that has been discussed in the rural states that I've just explained for about the last 10 years. It began in Nye County, Nevada, with the assumption that the federal government must prove its ownership to the state and thus to the county that it owns the federal land, that it has a deed to the land. And if it does or it does not have the deed to the land, then the land can be used. At that point, which was where the spark point on this whole thing was, to fund a school in a rural area. This was on the cover of, this exact issue was on the cover of Time magazine, I believe, in 93. This issue is the beginning of a friend of mine's book called Green Backlash, in which you actually lay out the constitutional differences between who owns the land and federal, state, county, local, private. This seems to be every now and then we have a committee hearing to have bills that I really enjoy and the history behind it. I think that this is a incredible start, but I just want to explain to the committee that this issue is this is a very large issue. It's a shift in policy, and I'm 100% supportive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, if I may add to that. Presently, the cattle industry is in dire straits, and a number of our ranchers are selling off their property, selling their herds to try to get cash flow. But they face another huge issue. As you know, most of the eastern side of the state, when it was homesteaded, the ranchers homesteaded the bottom lands, the best lands, and the rest of the property was left idle for many, many years. And then cattle grazing, they began to allow their cattle to just go out there and graze, even though it was still in federal ownership because it had not been homesteaded or granted away. Since the federal government decided there was a problem because they didn't know who should be able to graze it, and they passed the Taylor Grazing Act. Presently, what happens if you have base property, that means you own the land, and that's usually the better land, and it has some hay meadows and water and things. If you own that land, then you may get a permit from the federal government to graze a certain portion of those federal lands, and which they're also used for multiple uses. What's happening is that because of endangered species and this sort of thing, I had a call yesterday where a rancher will totally be prohibited from turning out on those federal lands because of red band trout may be in the area and may be in danger of becoming extinct. A lot of maize, but the reality is, without that grazing permit on those federal lands, he's out of business. He's on the edge of going out of business now because of the market, but he will be totally out of business. Then he will try to sell his land, and who's going to buy his property when it's been proven that it's going out of business, and he can't use anything else, that property, for anything else but ranching with our land use law. So we're facing a huge dilemma, and the more the federal government purchases these better lands, the more encroachment they'll have on putting more people out of business. It is very, very serious issue with the cattle industry in Oregon.
Mr. Gianella.
Mr. Chairman, Glenn, would you explain to me what's going on in the Snake River area?
Sure. Well, Representative Gianella, the Snake River area has a number of issues, whether it be dams, whether it be experimental populations of mountain sheep,
taking of land. Is there a move or a proposal to take land in that area, in the Snake River area?
Sure. Well, Representative Gianella, this part of this depends upon what you call taking of lands, because if you're talking about those federal lands already in ownership and someone is grazing them, and if so they have a property right, if you're talking about reducing the cattle grazing, yes, that's a taking of land because it takes away their right to the forage. The Owyhee River, and I'm not sure if that may be what you're talking about, but the Owyhee River in Malheur County is there's a big movement right now to make a huge national monument out of that, which will take private property and the grazing rights and the whole nine yards. But I'm not familiar with particulars on Snake River private property. I know that the people that are in the Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area, which borders Idaho just with the Snake River across the river between the two states, and I used to live in that county, and I know people who live down on that in that area that are totally restricted what they can do with a private property simply because they're in the Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area. And it's unbelievable. You kind of wonder if you're really in the United States of America, if we wanted to spend the time and go into the details of that, of what they, basically what they can't do, and what they can do is very, very limited.
Trustee Taylor.
I don't know if you heard, thank you, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you heard Mr. Sombrink say, the last measure we passed, which was the memorial to Congress asking for $15 million to provide for some wildlife refuges and bird sanctuaries. And I assume that if we should get that money, that would entail a purchase of some land. It seems to me that what we've done a lot here this legislative session, especially in this committee, is talk about if you want to use the land, you should buy it. And I've heard that over and over here. And so now you have come before us with a proposal that actually seems to me to put up barriers to the purchase of land for the things that we think are important as a society, like Senate Joint Memorial 13. I understand your concern about blocking away grazing lands by allowing them to become a scenic area or whatever, but I guess I am more concerned that we as a legislature take on responsibility of giving our stamp or allowing the counties to give their stamp when I think these are issues that actually do concern us statewide. I'm familiar with the Wahee Reservoir area and in Mount Hood County, and I think it would be the best of all worlds if we could accommodate both grazing and the recreational needs of the population.
Chair, well, Representative Taylor, I understand what you're talking about. The only thing that this provision would do would be allow you to scrutinize, it could prohibit, and if at the county level, it could prohibit. But in the goose situation of the previous bill, what it would simply do is the county would say, well, where should this be? The people of the county would have a right to talk and lobby their county government in order to say, where should it be? Would it be in a place that would actually just attract more geese, which would cause more problems? The local people would know best where that would be. If, in fact, they said, we need a wildlife refuge to entice them away from the fields, this is a great deal, they simply put their blessing on it. But if the federal government was coming in to purchase something just because it seemed attractive to them, but not the county, then the county and the people of the county would have certainly have a voice in this. And I should add also, although he's not here, Gil Riddell mentioned to me yesterday, the Association of Oregon Counties did endorse this bill.
Very good. Other questions?
Glenn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Canton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. As the speaker indicated, Gil Riddell would normally be here. This is his area of work, but he's next door in the Revenue Committee with the wine tax exemption. So I'm here in his place, and I do want to indicate that we do endorse Senate Bill 989. We've had a long-standing policy of trying to find a way to address the continual expansion of public lands at the federal level and even sort of privately, where it takes them out of private hands so they become non-taxable. We have the issue that I remember working the first year I was here, trying to deal with acquisition of private land by Nature Conservancy and other groups that took it out of tax status. And it's some of these counties are just beginning to the point they don't have much of a property tax base at all. We also, from the county standpoint, have had a great deal of effort devoted to trying to resolve the forest issue. The change in the management of the forest and the impact of that not only on forest receipts that help fund the county roads, but also on the communities there. And there is a clear change in where the Forest Service is going. This happened to be reading a paper last night that wasn't from this state, but it was a Forest Service supervisor, and they're beginning to really change where they're headed. And I think it at least raises for you a question: should you begin to exercise a little more of your authority in the field where the acquisitions are going to occur? Because I was reading this, the person with the Forest Service supervisor now in Nevada and was Yellowstone National Area, and she said the agency's new direction is permanent and will not be changed by the combination of a Republican administration and a Republican Congress, so some of this momentum could be sapped. They may slow us, but I don't think they could really slip us back. That some of the agency find the new atmosphere hard to take, she told a questioner in the audience of about 200 people, but they won't be around forever. They're dinosaurs, she said, they'll die. And she was referring to the fact that agencies change is to, the agency has to learn to talk about the unmentionable. They include things like beauty, character, spirituality, and sense of place. Now, the question is, are we talking about national forests for those purposes, or does the national forest begin to fit other issues that are related to land being right there in the county? And so at least, I guess, from that point of view and from the county's point of view, when we're out there struggling with this issue, trying to work with the federal agencies and the federal government, it would be nice to have some support from the legislature in particular on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Nancy Morgan?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, that I think from the county's point of view, that this is an incredibly important issue. I know that Douglas County and Josephine counties, two counties that I recommend or represent, Douglas County is just under half owned by the federal government, and Josephine County is actually more than half owned by the federal government. And the decisions that are made with regard to those federal lands have profound social and economic impacts on the counties. And indeed, the OMC counties right now are in financial freefall because the subsidies from timber harvesting that went on in those counties is about to end. And so you've got a situation where a federal decision that took place with very, very little local input but has a profound local impact is unfolding in those areas now. And as we look at the continued popularity of land swaps and things like the Nature Conservancy moving in and buying private lands, using public funds for that, I think that the state does need to try to exert as much control as possible over what's going on with those lands. And it isn't an issue that has an impact in the populated areas of the state. I don't think that there's anybody at this end of the Willamette Valley that really cares very much about the federal government's presence in the state. But in the rural areas of the state, it's a profoundly important issue and the one that we need to continue to pay attention to.
That's an action.
Follow up comment. Representative Morgan is absolutely on point. These issues in rural counties, not only in Douglas and Josephine counties where Representative Morgan and I are from, but also east of San Jose, you start to get into the issue of taxation and whether or not who owns that land and what is the tax base. And when you have the dwindling amount of tax base getting snatched up by the federal government, which, to my knowledge, doesn't sell property very often. In fact, they don't sell property very often. You start to have all the services cut. But that is really the heart of the issue. We have a thing in Southern Oregon on our OMC land. It's the same issue synonymous with what happens in Eastern Oregon. But just, again, back for history, I believe it was in 1820, and I can't remember the Supreme Court decision case, but it was the case that said that states cannot tax the federal government. It is the act that sets up banking in America as we know it. And the roots of the court case, which lost, I believe, 5 years ago, goes back all the way to that Supreme Court case and asked, if you own the land under the federal, under the Constitution, which is shaky, as the federal papers point out, then is there a taxable income there? I mean, like I again, I don't want to overtalk a bill, but this issue is so large. This is just the beginning of getting it back under control. It's not a matter of do they own land or are we not going to sell land or anything like that. It's a matter of can you halt the growth of the federal government owning the county board? That's what's at stake, because they already do own over 50%.
And the great local and state rights bill. No doubt about it.
For over 10 years we've been, in fact, in a glory first net. And Stonebrink was working with National Grassroots on this issue that we came right out in Nevada, Arizona, concerns down there in counties and their battles.
Okay. Let's bring up Jennifer Robinson.
Thank you, Chair Welch, members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Robinson with the Division of State Lands. I merely wanted to clarify for Representative Taylor the question about ACE navigation. What 272.020 refers to are navigable waters of the United States. Those are specified by the Coast Guard as those waters in which large vessels can make way. They have not changed appreciably in lifetime. They basically are areas where they maintain buoys and day markers to aid large vessels in order to find the channel. And the Coast Guard, they also happen to be navigable for purposes of title for state ownership, but that is not the issue here. These are waters that are just declared to be navigable for purposes of navigation by the U.S. Coast Guard. Typically, the Coast Guard does not acquire title to submersion submersible lands for their buoys and day markers. They receive a license from us, which is a bare right to occupy the surface of the water or, if they need to anchor their buoys, a small portion of the bed. It would be our concern that as navigation channels change, which they can as a matter of topology, and the Coast Guard needs to move a buoy and needs to get a license from us, that this could, even though it only relates to acquiring title, could for some reason chill our ability to help the Coast Guard with that navigation servitude.
President Cruz.
But basically, this deal is with acquiring title. Since I'm acquiring title, I'm not quite sure how I see where it impacts.
Representative Welch, Chair Cruz, we're assuming it would not, but we don't know how the federal government might interpret this or how a court might interpret this. If I might, Chair Welch, I can also respond to Representative Janelle's question about Hell's Canyon and what the issue is there. I don't know a lot about it, but I do know that the basic issue is that there were a number of grazing allotments within that national recreation area that were grazed historically, and they took the cattle off of them a number of years ago, and the question now is whether they should reopen them for grazing. They are not currently used for grazing. There are large areas in there that are currently not used by the federal government for grazing, and the question is whether they should reopen them to local residents for grazing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. What's in GMO?
Is it closed to the public? Is it closed ground?
Chair Welsh, Representative GMO, no. It's open to the public for recreation.
Is there a proposal to close any of those grounds to the public?
Chair Welsh, Representative GMO, no, that I know.
Other questions? Thank you. Anyone that has not signed up on Senate Bill 989 would like to give testimony? Okay.
Mr. Chair, just ask a question maybe of our committee administrator. I see that under the statutes that we've been given, the excerpt, that the county governing body must now consent. And that's part of the statute that's being repealed. And so I'm confused by that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, as I read those statutes that are repealed, currently the counties do have to consent with respect to additions to national forests. So that statute is being repealed, but that same provision is coming back in the new language. I like the questions I can ask.
So we're taking it out.
Okay.
Any other
questions?
I will close a hearing on Senate Bill 989 and open a fourth session on Senate Bill 989.
That's approved. Senate Bill 989 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
That's approved. Move Senate Bill 989 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. For the discussion. Representative Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, I won't be supporting the bill. It's been characterized as a state's rights issue, but actually I think it goes one level farther than that. And that is, I think we've seen some examples of that both in the state and other areas where I understand the complexities of these issues and how controversial they are, but I can imagine cases under which there is something that is of statewide significance being important to the people of the state that may not be viewed by the same as by the residents of the individual county of the state. And it's a basic question of whose interests our government has an obligation to represent, whether we take it down to the smallest level or whether, if there's a statewide interest, that prevails. And I just think this goes a little bit too far, because I can tell you that in some of those counties, you probably would never approve another acquisition by the federal government.
Okay. And then that'd be just fun.
And that's a philosophical disagreement.
I guess Sharon Nashfield on this is for the United States to acquire land, additional land, and they certainly have more than I think is appropriate now, basically without any input from anybody but themselves, is incredibly inappropriate. And that's what we've got now, is they, you know, do we want, we have seen a move by the federal government to make massive acquisitions in states, like they did in Utah. And anything we can do to prevent that from happening, I think is totally appropriate. And I think this is not only a very strong message, but this is a very strong tool that will make sure that the interests of the state of Oregon rise above the interests of the East Coast. And I will support the result.
Chris Hayes, historically, I believe this is a strong aspect of this committee members. This is fundamentally states' rights issue. Fundamentally. You can go back to the United States Supreme Court and go back to the Constitution, Federalist Papers, the Articles. You can go all the way back. There's a fundamental core issue here between who owns the land. And you can go back to the Louisiana Purchase and the creation of Oregon, really. I think, though, that in a rural area where this is, where we're talking about this issue, you have the federal government in competition with individual citizens and their ability to govern themselves at the county level. And that's what we have. And if you can put in this pool of other things.
Sure. I'd just like to comment that as part of my legislative assignment, I went to a conference in Idaho, my former home state, and visited the Bud Purdy Ranch in the Peekaboo Mountains, and there the Nature Conservancy abuts his ranch, and it is a wonderful spring-fed, year-round creek that runs through his property, and there are float fishermen on the creek, and Bud has one of the largest carrel operations in that area. And they peacefully coexist there. And I see this as a rather adversarial kind of approach rather than that one. I will not support it for that reason.
I think it's a wonderful bill, and I'm excited about it. I think 52%, if 52% of Oregon's land is already owned by the federal government, how much more do they need? And how much more are they going to take? I think it's a wonderful bill. I'll be again.
Well, not to be left out here.
I would just like to build on Representative Atkinson's comments. I think that his analysis of the situation is right on. And what I can add from my personal experience is that since the Endangered Species Act has kind of come to the front burner in Oregon, and we've gone through the listing of the spotted owl and now through the listing of various fish species, and we're starting to see the Federal Clean Water Act be another piece of legislation that's coming to the front burner in Oregon, that really what this is going to come down to more and more clearly over time is who controls. Does the federal government control the land or the water in the state of Oregon, or does the state of Oregon control the land and the water in the state of Oregon? And I think that pieces of legislation like the one that we're considering right now are going to become increasingly important as the sides get drawn up, because it is going to be a battle. And the battle is going to be about who controls the land and who controls the water in the state.
It was fundamentally designed in the beginning that private property would support local governments and local seats, and we're losing that battle continuously here. And I certainly support these efforts, and I think they will continue, certainly in the West. The argument is there and has been for over 10 years, and it has been even longer than that. But if we can help support our not only private property, the federal government, socialist government that we have presently, is continuously trying to take everything away and take care of us. And I think that is the gist of it. And those of us at the local level that support these types of efforts have to be bold and have to move forward. And on these small but I think significant battles, we have to pass that message on to those who run for Congress and those who are in the certainly in the presidential and administration level. They have to understand what it takes to run a county and a state, and our battle should be between the state and the county and the federal government. Only within what was intended as far as government was concerned to serve us, and with We've lost. We're continuously losing.
Well, I just want to be very clear here that this takes away individual property rights. This is my right to sell my land to the highest bidder. And I get rather tired of using the word socialist for anything one opposes without any analysis behind it. And I don't know if this is a good bill or not. I'm not sure exactly what the problem is with public buildings under authority of the Act of Congress being able to be established. This is sweeping. I'm concerned about the navigation sites. We've raised a lot of issues related to federal government and the amount of land they own in a rather undiscriminating manner, and I will not support this bill.
All right. We have the motion before us. The Senate Bill 989 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
No. Aye. Any required number of votes? Senate Bill 989 passed 4-2 passed recommendation. 989B. Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I'll carry it.
Yeah.
Let's be true. And we will close the work session on this bill. 989?
Yes.
Well, we don't have co-chairs, as I understand, but you can.
I think this is co-chair 34.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can state that the Rescue Vacuum will be co-chair on Senate Bill 989. All right. We close the work session on Senate Bill 989, open the work session on Senate Bill 965. It's approved.
I move Senate Bill 965 to support the due pass recommendation.
President Cruz moves Senate Bill 965 to support the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We just passed a bill that said the county's decision was important, and here we're not allowing an amendment that was requested by the county that says they'd like to be involved in the decision. And I'm sort of trying for consistency here.
Give it and take it away. I think that's precisely the argument between the county and the state, and I understand that. And I think what we're talking about absolutely is a taxing district and their ability. They're already taxing for the purpose of caring to be able to provide within their own district an exemption that they could not otherwise do that within a small district. And we have allowed within state statute certain rules for those taxing districts, and we've said small taxing districts within other districts are important. And what we're providing here is certainly a difference between the county and a local taxing district, but something that is, I think, fundamentally, again, important to the local and small common denominator in the taxing district, and that's what we're talking about here, being able to provide service to their medical services within that small district is very important, and to rural Oregon. And certainly having a big portion of rural Oregon in my district, I think this is a good bill.
Mr. Chair,
Christine.
Did we have any testimony on this bill from the county?
Yes, we did. And they did propose a dash one amendment. Would you like to hear from the county or from the testimony, Mr. Patterson?
They were in support of it.
No, the counties are not in support without the Dash 1 lane.
If the Dash 1s, they are?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, at least they're proposing Dash 1. I think they would be in support of that.
Okay.
Would you like further explanation of the Dash 1 amendment?
I'm happy.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the vote?
Aye.
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 Aye. And the required number of votes in the bill 965 passes to the floor to pass the recommendation. Who would like to be the chair? Director General. Thank you very much. Okay, the close of the work session is in the bill 965. And we open a work session, open a hearing on Senate Bill 461. Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chair Wells, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregon International. We move from public lands issues to the more mundane issue of rightness and takings. Senate Bill 461 is a compromise bill that deals with the issue of rightness as it relates to taking law under both the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon Constitution. The takings, the court cases on takings law are very, I think unclear is the best word we can use for them, but one thing is clear, both under the Oregon Constitution and under the federal Constitution, and that is if a local government or a state government or the federal government through some type of regulation or combination of regulations deprives a landowner of all economic value of their property, then the government is required to compensate that landowner based on the fair market value of that piece of property. That issue is beyond dispute, like I say, under both the Oregon and the federal constitution. The problem is trying to get to into court and show proof to the court that the regulations or the combination of regulations have taken away all the value of your land. Typically in any zoning district, a forest zone, a farm zone, or a residential zone, it's something in the city, there are a number of uses that are allowed within that zone. In order for a landowner to show that a regulation or combination of regulations have deprived the landowner of all value of the property, the landowner has to show that they can't, at least we think, they have to show that none of the uses that are allowed in the zoning district would be allowed on that particular piece of property for some reason. Or either that or that the ones that would be allowed wouldn't result in any economic value to the property. Now, if I walk into court and let's say I apply for a house and I walk in, and the local government denies me for a dwelling permit, at that point, if I think that based on that denial there isn't any economic value left in my property, I can march into court, pay my filing fee, and sue the state or the local or the federal government, whoever imposed the regulation, and argue that as a result of that regulation, it's taken away all the value of my property. Typically, what will happen is the government, and as a defense, will raise the issue of rightness and argue that I haven't proven that there aren't other uses that they would allow on the property that would have some type of economic value. And in order for me to do that, the court would then probably dismiss my case and make me go back to the local government and apply for all of the other uses that are allowed in the zone. The problem is if there are multiple uses allowed in the zone, in Multnomah County, for example, in the forest zone, there are 28 different uses. If I have to go back, if I have to go to Multnomah County and apply for 28 separate uses and get denials of all of those before I can go into court and just have my day in court, I'm going to be out at least $42,000 just to get my day in court. So in other words, I would have to go to Multnomah County, submit 28 separate applications at $1,550 a pop, even though there are things, let's say in the forest zone, there are things such as, you know, cemeteries and cell site towers and things like that, and in most pieces of property you're not going to apply for to begin with. But in order to get my day in court, to raise my takings claim and avoid a rightness defense, I would have to submit applications for all 28 of those uses and pay the Multnomah County $1,550 a pop. The irony of those applications is on a number of the applications you would submit, your application would essentially say, I can't qualify for this, but I have to apply for this so the court doesn't kick me out on a rightness theory when I come in on a takings claim, so please deny me. It seems kind of a frivolous pursuit both for the landowner and for the local government. Based on that rightness doctrine, we came up with 461. The amendment, what the bill will do is it will allow you, based after you go in and apply initially and get a denial, it will allow you to come back and submit an application, essentially one application for every use that's allowed in that zone. Based on that single application, the local government will then tell you whether or not you qualify for any of the, which ones of the uses, if any, you qualify for in that zone, and then you can have a determination as to whether any of those uses that the local government says you qualify for would be economically viable. It's a good compromise bill, both from the local government perspective and from ours, in as much as we should be able to save some money by not having to submit, using Multnomah County's example, 28 applications at $1,550 apiece. At the same time, the local governments have, instead of the standard 120 or 150 days under this bill, the local government would have 240 days for those for the application that asks for all of the uses in the zone. So rather than me coming in with 28 applications and a check for $42,000 and saying to Multnomah County, here's my 28 applications, you've got 120 days to decide, or 150. If you don't decide in 150, I'm going to march into circuit court with a writ of mandamus, like we've talked about in the earlier bill. I will now be able to submit a single application. They'll have 240 days, and they'll decide based on that, during that time, which of the uses I've applied for that I would qualify for. We worked out the amendments to the bill on the Senate side with the work group, and I don't think there's any opposition. The bill passed the Senate side 28-2. I don't know why we had two opposing votes. With that, we think it's a nice, reasonable compromise.
I understand you're asking for them to prove a whole lot of things here, but it seems like an incredibly unreasonable amount of time for a decision when you're a landowner sitting out there. You're going to have a year of basic inactivity and not knowing any objections to proceed with it.
Chair Welch, Representative Cruz, that's right. The only thing I can tell you is that the trade-off for that was the saving, instead of having to file, like in the Multnomah County example, $42,000 just to get your day in court, will now only have to apply for, submit one application and pay one filing fee. So that was the trade-off.
And we have some the A4s or some of the claims test.
The A4 amendments, I believe, were drafted by Ledge Council to resolve conflict with, I believe, Senate Bill 628, which is the 150-day rule for the counties. It just adds the language on lines 12 and 13, or 150 days is appropriate. So,
okay. I know the Senate report, it did get off the Senate floor also over there, and this bill also. You said you don't know in your testimony anyone that's hint of anything that the governor's office is all put in on this one.
Chair Welsh, we have talked with both Robin McCarthy-Phillips from the governor's Natural Resource Policy Advisor, and Richard Whitman from the Attorney General's office, who both say that this bill is fine.
Questions of Mr. Honeycutt? That's the name of Devin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Honeycutt, is it assumed that what we're talking about here, and you talk about a particular planning district or zone, are what the permitted and conditional uses would be in that zone, and you're not talking about what variances might be possible from that in terms of or actual zone changes?
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, I think the easiest way that I can describe this is what this bill does is it, instead of me having to submit 28 different applications and have the local government make 28 separate decisions, I will submit one application for all of the uses. The local government, based on what I submit, just like if I was submitting a separate application for each one, will determine whether I have met the criteria based on the information I have submitted, including any variance criteria.
Follow up. But you're not talking about them and analyzing, you know, actually plan map and then changes in zoning for the area in the...
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, the application would also include, or could also include, an application for any zone change that was possible as well.
Okay. And final question, Mr. Chair. With this thing, you're talking about the land use application, not the portion of future, which would be if you were going to actually develop, you know, design or architectural review. You're not talking about that level.
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, anything that would be a condition of approval wouldn't be, the application would be your standard application for whatever the conditional or permitted use was allowed in the zone. The applicant would continue to bear the burden of proving that they meet the qualifications for the uses in that zone. And then if there were conditions of approval or one of the conditions of approval may be design review. If that's the condition of approval, then obviously the local government would then say that you meet this, you qualify for this subject to design review. And then you would go through your design review process.
Thank you.
It's just essentially what we're doing is we're trying to take all of the applications allowed in the zone and combine them in efforts to save money into a single application. But all of the other rules that apply to your normal land use applications would continue to apply.
Mr. Chairman, final follow-up.
Yes.
Follow-up, Mr. Rector. Although it could be somebody that was doing this for the first time, I think the anticipation would be here that someone that would be making this broad application would be probably someone that had been previously denied. Would that be? It could be either way, but I wouldn't.
Chair Welsh, Representative Devlin, that's correct. You'll notice that we don't prescribe a fee within this bill. So I would imagine that the local government, the fee for one of these applications will be a little bit higher than your normal application fee. It would behoove the landowner to apply for the one use that they want in the first instance, and then if that use is denied and they don't think that any of the other uses would be economically viable, then they could go ahead and use this application procedure instead of having to submit separate applications for all of them.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Thank you. You could clarify something for me. I think this is kind of a long one. So if I'm applying, I have to lay out exactly what I'm applying for.
As Chair Welsh, Representative Floyd, that's correct.
Okay, so I'm not expecting that the local government is going to say, you know, that I want to apply for any possible variation out there, and that the local government is going to have
just identified which one I could qualify for.
Chair Wells, Representative Tafori, the landowner would describe what applications they are applying for. The landowner would continue to bear the burden of proving that they meet whatever qualifications the local government has for that particular use. If the landowner didn't meet those qualifications, then the local government would probably deny, I would assume.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Charlie Kundell?
Good morning, Chairman Welsh and members of the committee. My name is Charlie Sundell on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. And as an original member of the working group, which modified this bill to bring it into its current form, 1,000 Friends very much supports this bill in its current form over the form that it was before. However, we're neutral on the bill. Frankly, it's kind of an ambivalence about the bill. I personally consider it unlikely that the statutory provisions here would be used in the future. We're certainly a lot more inclined to support the bill, however, if one single issue were addressed, and it's one that I've not been able to make headway on with the proponents, and it responds to the point made by Representative Cruz. The 120-day rule under current law and this new 240-day rule under the bill before you, there's a whole range of land use applications that get processed all the time, dozens around the state every week or 2 weeks, which are called plan amendment land use decisions, that somebody, for example, wants to change the zoning on their property, so they have to amend the comprehensive plan as it pertains to their individual property and so forth. Those land use decisions are processed with no time limit imposed on them by state law, and they're processed in an expedient manner. They're processed without undue delay. In fact, they're processed at lightning speeds relative to virtually every other state in the United States. And I don't see any reason why this bill should place an arbitrary time limit, even what may seem like a very, very generous time limit. There is still a remote risk when you have a time limit of any kind involved, such as in a bill like this, that writ of mandamus at circuit court can be brought to bear in the case. And remember, when you're talking about the writ of mandamus, that's the applicant going to circuit court not to get the judge to order the local government to decide the decision. The judge orders the local government to approve the decision. Now, if you're talking about this new consolidated application for all the uses in the zone, I consider the bill to contain an ambiguity in that it's suggesting that when the 240-day clock runs out, and again, this is a new, unprecedented type of procedure, you could have a circuit court judge ordering the local government to approve all the uses that are allowed in the underlying zone if for some reason, under this new unprecedented procedure, the local government is not able to act within the time frame. And there may be occurrences why that may take place. We're in a very unusual, extraordinary situation here in Oregon right now with a backlog of land use appeals. It's a land use board of appeals as a result of delayed Senate confirmation of legal judges. We have a lot of growth going on in some areas of the state with maybe some underfunded planning departments. So there's some delay going on in the planning approval process in Oregon now. Nevertheless, permit approval is very, very fast in Oregon compared to other states. I think that's an irrefutable proposition. I'm not concerned about undue delay or landowners getting hassled under this process. I just don't see the need for any arbitrary time limit there when so many land use decisions get processed with no time limit at all. So my recommendation to this committee would be to approve the bill, but without that 240-day time limit included in it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Questions?
Wasn't the 240 day time limit that was already doubled, wasn't it, from the previous?
From the existing 120 or 150 day time limit that's involved.
Apparently so. I was in the initial work group, but then I stopped being consulted after our first meeting. So I'm not sure how they arrived at that figure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Sure. All right. Thank you very much, Tom. I close the hearing on Senate Bill 461. Open the work session on Senate Bill 462. I
move dash H1 members to
the Senate Court. This includes the dash H4 amendments to Senate Bill 461. Do you have any further discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so moved. President Cruz has moved Senate Bill 461 as amended to the floor of the Duke House recommendation. 461A. For the discussion. Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. And required number to vote. Senate Bill 461, as amended, has the close to pass recommendation. Let's close the work session.
I'll carry it.
Very much. And you.
The chair will carry.
I like to dress things this morning.
I would dream of standing in your way.
Would you like to hear?
I'll carry if you want to carry.
No, I'll carry. I have no problem.
We could co-carry.
There you go.
Okay, we can do that. Taking care of it. Don't compromise here. Okay. Taking care of it. That's well, and Morgan will co-carry this. And we close our work session on Senate Bill 461, having no further business for the day.
Yes. I'm wondering if I should vote on the day
that I missed. Absolutely.
Close our work session, and we will open for a representative before to vote on the Senate Joint Memorial 13. You were missing for that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello,
Jim. Thank you for the support of us here. And Senate Bill 989.
On that one, however, I will be voting no.
Okay. Is there any other resident here not present like to vote on the bill?
Okay.
Thank you. Adjourn for the day, Bill. Well, we,